From NPR News in New York, this is the Bryant Park Project with Allison Stewart and Luke Burbank.
It's the Bryant Park Project with Luke Burbank and Allison Stewart from NPR News. Jeez Louise, these headphones
are really loud.
I just turned it up to 11.
Oh.
Right as that music was playing, I think. If you see blood
coming out of your ear,
one
we know why.
Little stream of blood coming out of my left ear. That's what that is.
He's Luke Burbank. I'm Allison Stewart. Can I tell you about my brush with the paparazzi?
Yes, please.
It wasn't outside of our studios. They weren't waiting for Ira Flatto. They were actually across the street from my house where they're filming a new movie, and there were just these guys with those cameras that are with the lenses the size of Pringles cans.
Yeah.
Pointed at this one trailer, and people with their cell phones up, ready to take pictures. And I just whisper, girl, who's in there? I'm thinking it's some huge star. Yeah. Ashton Kutcher.
That's pretty big.
Oh, come on.
Let me tell you about life in L.A. is you'll see a set. They'll have five blocks shut down, and you'll think, like, oh, my gosh, it's Steven Spielberg. You'll go ask a guy who has, like, you know, walkie-talkie. He'll go, it's a Preparation H commercial.
And
they're not even shooting the cool part of it. It's just like the shot of the tube. It's always very underwhelming.
In between me and my sugar-free Red Bull. That's all I know. Paparazzi out of the way. I don't care. Ashton, whoever. Hey, anyway, coming up on the show today. 2 years ago today, Hurricane Katrina struck the Gulf Coast. We're going to talk to a journalist and a longtime New Orleans resident who did not leave. He rode through the whole thing. Doug McCash is going to join us.
Also, speaking of Ashton Kutcher and people who might have $200,000 to throw down on something, soon Virgin, Richard Branson, Virgin Airlines, mm-hmm. Virgin Mobile, they're going to launch a space kind of airline, Virgin Galactic. We're going to talk about that and how safe or not safe it might be.
For all you parents out there, and even non-parents, this has got to get your attention. There's an entire movement afoot to take kids out of diapers, the diaper-free movement before they're even 1 year old. So we'll discuss it.
And Burning Man got going a little earlier than people had expected out in the Nevada desert this week. We'll give you all the patchouli-drenched details of that. But first, it's time for our top story.
I am not gay. I never have been gay.
That's Idaho Republican Senator Larry Craig responding to the revelation that he pleaded guilty to disorderly conduct after an incident in a Minneapolis airport men's room where he allegedly attempted to solicit some sort of sexual encounter from a male undercover police officer in a stall. The 62-year-old three-term senator, a conservative who spent much of his political career in opposition to gay rights, made his first public comments since news of the arrest. He said he regrets pleading guilty.
While I was not involved in any inappropriate conduct at the Minneapolis airport or anywhere else, I chose to plead guilty to a lesser charge in hopes of making it go away. I did not seek any counsel, either from an attorney, staff, friends, or family. That was a mistake.
Craig said he's the victim of, in his words, a witch hunt by the Idaho Statesman newspaper, which has been investigating him for a long time about allegations that he has led a homosexual lifestyle. He said the strain of that investigation caused him to make the decision to plead guilty to this event in the Minneapolis airport. The Statesman investigation has turned up some revelations. These are revelations that Senator Craig has denied, including the statement of a 40-year-old male who says that he had consensual oral sex with Senator Craig in the men's room at Union Station in Washington, D.C.
Now, allegation about Craig's involvement in illicit gay sex date back farther than that. Back in July of 1982, when Craig was a congressman, there was a congressional paid scandal very similar to the Mark Foley scandal of last year, one that involved a male congressman and having sexual relations with male pages. Here is a clip from July 2nd, 1982, from an ABC News report.
The names of congressmen alleged to be involved in the scandal have remained secret. But Idaho Republican Congressman Larry Craig, concerned that his name had been implicated, issued a public denial.
Persons who are unmarried, as I am, by choice or by circumstance, have always been the subject of innuendos, gossip, and false accusations. I think this is despicable.
Now, we got to point out that Craig was not actually charged with any crimes back in 1982. He was charged, though, this summer and pleaded guilty after that incident in the airport bathroom. He's also not getting very much support from fellow Republicans.
Craig was a Senate liaison for presidential candidate Mitt Romney until yesterday. Craig stepped down from that role, and Romney made a statement in which he said of Craig, quote, he's disappointed the American people. On the Tonight Show last night, John McCain called Craig's actions, quote, disgraceful.
And there are a couple of really interesting side angles to this story that we're going to get into in a few minutes. First, there's the whole issue of gay politicians and them being outed against their will. You know, we can't say if that's really what's happening here with Larry Craig, but we're going to talk to a gay activist named Mike Rogers. He has a blog called Blog Active. This is actually where a lot of this Larry Craig stuff kind of got rolling a couple years ago.
We're also going to ask a couple questions. Since it's agreed that nothing illicit actually happened in that men's room in Minneapolis, exactly what did Larry Craig do to get arrested? How was the law broken? Is trying to pick someone up in an airport different than, you know, say, being sexually explicit and trying to pick him up in the bar? We're going to have a little bit of an explainer on that.
This is NPR.
But first, here's Matt Martinez with the news.
Thanks, guys. Hello, everyone. It's been 2 years since Hurricane Katrina made landfall and devastated New Orleans and other cities and towns along the Gulf Coast. Many of the displaced have still not returned home. We mark the second anniversary of the storm later on in the program with Doug McCash, a reporter for the New Orleans Times-Picayune. The Taliban released 12 of 19 South Korean missionaries held hostage. That happened today. South Korea reaffirmed a pledge it made before the hostage crisis to begin withdrawing its troops from Afghanistan by the end of this year. Seoul also said it would prevent South Korean Christian missionaries from working in the country, something it had already promised to do. The South Koreans were released to the Red Cross at two separate locations in central Afghanistan. Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr ordered a six-month suspension of activities by his Mahdi army militia. It's an effort to reorganize the force, and an aide for the cleric says the militia will no longer attack U.S. and coalition troops. The organization has reportedly broken into factions, some of which the U.S. maintains are trained and supplied by Iran. A group of eight Iranians were detained and then released by U.S. forces today. The group included two Iranian diplomats. They were detained because unauthorized weapons were found in their cars. An advisor to the top U.S. general in Iraq called the situation regrettable. The incident comes a day after President Bush strongly criticized Iran in a speech at the American Legion convention in Reno, Nevada. A military jury reprimanded the only officer court-martialed in the Abu Ghraib abuse scandal. Army Lieutenant Colonel Stephen L. Jordan will not serve any prison time for disobeying an order to keep silent about the abuse investigation. Yesterday, the jury acquitted him of all three charges directly related to the mistreatment of detainees at the U.S.-run prison in Iraq. The acquittal absolves Jordan of responsibility for the actions of 11 lower-ranking soldiers who have been convicted for their roles at Abu Ghraib. South Africa's health department said it has recalled 20 million condoms that may be defective. An official has been accused of taking bribes from a manufacturer and allowing faulty condoms to pass quality assurance requirements. South Africa has one of the world's highest HIV infection rates, with an estimated 12% of its 47 million people infected with the virus. And South Dakota Senator Tim Johnson says he's coming back to the Senate. 8 months ago, the Democrat suffered a life-threatening brain hemorrhage. Johnson made an appearance at the Sioux Falls Convention Center in a wheelchair. He rose to his feet and waved to the crowd. The senator's face and speech showed the effects of the trauma, but he joked that his condition gives him an advantage over his colleagues because his brain works faster than his mouth. I'm Matt Martinez. The news is always online at npr.org. Back to you, Luke and Allison.
Thank you, Maddie.
Idaho Senator Larry Craig singled out the local paper in yesterday's news conference, it's the Idaho Statesman for those who don't know, for going on what he called a witch hunt to create trouble for him by investigating his arrest for lewd conduct as well as past suggestions that the married conservative senator had solicited gay sex. Today the paper responded saying, hey, Craig made his own mess. In an Idaho Statesman editorial, there's also a reference to a, quote, gay rights activist who have taken to the blogosphere to call him a hypocrite. This is a reference likely to blogactive.com, a site that lists allegedly gay politicians and their voting records, including Senator Larry Craig. The founder of Blog Active joins us today. Mike Rogers is on the phone. Hi, Mike.
Good morning.
So is the paper's characterization of you and your blog as activists correct?
Well, you know, I tend to use the word activist by saying anybody who does anything is acting, so therefore they're an activist. You know, I'm a journalist and a reporter and do some media work on the web. In my spare time, I have this blog in which I report the cases of individuals who are both anti-gay and closeted. So I don't know if I would define exactly as an activist. How about citizen?
The Idaho Statesman and some of the more mainstream media seem to have picked up on this story, some of it from your site. How did you first hear about Senator Craig's alleged solicitations for gay sex?
Well, I think at this point he's admitted guilt in a court of law, so I don't think that they're alleged anymore.
Well, he admitted to the disorderly conduct.
Right. True, but, I mean, the police report was pretty clear what he was trying to do. But anyway, I guess that for me, I found out about him... I found about Larry Craig in July of 2004, and it took about 25 months for me to pull together all the sourcing and the other folks that I spoke to be able to report on it in October of last year.
Now, Larry Craig, I'm sure you heard the news conference came out yesterday and stated, pardon the pun, he spoke in his news conference yesterday and stated clearly that he is not gay. So how did you confirm what you've written about him on your site?
Well, Larry Craig may not be gay. Larry Craig may be bisexual. Larry Craig may be a straight man in denial. There's so many different things that Larry Craig may or may not be. That's not really for me to figure out. He is a man who engages in sexual activity with other men.
And how do you know that for sure?
Because I have, spoken to three individuals who have given me characteristics of things about his physical features that would not normally be visible to people. So I believe that the evidence has been corroborated. And then when you look at the police report from this police officer in Minneapolis, it's pretty clear what he was doing.
Well, if, you know, I guess that's sort of still my, you know, Senator Craig would say that he's not any of those things. But I guess whether he is or not, why do you think it matters to the American public? Why do you think it's important for you to bring this stuff up if it's in relation to Senator Craig or some of the other people that are on your website?
Sure. Well, for me, the reason that I do it is because it's reporting hypocrisy in the government. Senator Craig, as we have seen, wants to live by a different set of rules. In fact, he slammed down his business card and said, "What do you think of that?"
And you're saying to the investigating person in Minneapolis is what you're referring to.
Correct. And so for me, it's not about outing someone who's gay. There are lots of gay Democrats, gay Republicans across the political spectrum who are in the closet in Congress and in offices around the country who are not engaging in gay bashing, who are not using gay marriage as a reason to get reelected, who are not supporting Don't Ask, Don't Tell and the Defense of Marriage Act. And those folks I have no interest in reporting on. So for me, it's basically a piece of government hypocrisy reporting that before me, no one else on the web has been willing to really touch.
Here's a question, though. Just because you're a gay politician, should you have to support certain – what if you don't believe in gay marriage? I mean, Clarence Thomas on the Supreme Court votes against affirmative action.
Absolutely. But he doesn't hide the fact by going to work every day under beige makeup that he's a black man. And I think I have no problem with somebody who's openly gay not voting for the organizational stands of various lesbian and gay groups if they're honest with the American people, just like I'd have no problem with a woman legislator standing up and saying, "I'm against abortion because I made the mistake 5 years ago." But if that same legislator says, "I'm against abortion and I discovered that she had an abortion last month," we're going to have to talk.
But doesn't a lot of this stuff presume – you just said that Larry Craig may not be gay. He could just be a straight guy who is engaged in, you know, various activities. Doesn't your whole thing presume he's gay though? Because if he's a straight guy who is engaged in some sex with men at some point, then he's not necessarily the same kind of hypocrite as if he's a gay man.
Oh, I still think he's a hypocrite. Basically, what Larry Craig wants to do is have sexual encounters with the very people he wants to deny equal rights to. So – call him gay, call him ex-gay. You know, a lot of these guys go through the religion track to be able to say, "I am not gay." And these religious camps actually beat into them, "You are not gay. You are not gay. You can overcome this. There is no gay." And so they actually teach them this psychologically that they're able to get away with saying, "I am not gay. I have never been gay." And it's a matter of semantics, I think. You know, he's having sex with other men. He has a 25-year history of being tied to sex scandals in Washington. In 1982 was the first time he went on the air to deny his involvement in that scandal, unprovoked no reason he went on the air. So I think we've seen here a consistent pattern. I think that Larry Craig, if he wants any shot of, you know, any respect, I think he'll just be a little more honest with the American people. He's really stretching it these days.
Before I let you go, you sound very confident in your reporting and in your sources, but what if you turn out to be wrong about Senator Craig? What will you do?
My blog has a 100% track record. I have no luxury, unlike most media who can come back the next day and say the caption was wrong or we regret that we implicated this person because we made a mistake and printed the wrong name. I don't have that luxury of an institution behind me with centuries, so I have to be very careful and get it right 100% of the time. Larry Craig does have sex with men. There's no fear in my mind that I'd ever be disproven on that.
The man sounds positive. He's Mike Rogers from Blog Active. Thanks for being on the Bryant Park Project today.
Thanks.
Sit down and stop moonwalking. We got a radio show to do.
Look, I can't. You know, my mind says no, but my penny loafers say yes. It's the Bryant Park Project. I'm Luke Burbank. That's Allison Stewart. Allie, you know, we were in that last segment going to also sort of talk about the legal specifics of what happened in this Minnesota airport. We didn't get to that, but we're going to get to that later on in the show.
And if we don't get to it later on the show for some reason, we'll put it on the blog. How about that? Is that a good deal?
I guess it'll have to do.
Time for something, stories that you just can't ignore. We like to call them the ramble.
I can moonwalk to this, too, for the record. Mm-hmm. Just, you know. The mayor of a Parisian suburb of... thank you for giving me the French word. Argentile? How would you say that, Allison?
That works for me. I speak Spanish.
Has agreed to suspend the use of a foul-smelling spray as a tactic for removing homeless people from parking garages. Mayor George Mothron says he would suspend the measure while waiting to hear proposals for other solutions. Apparently, they were trying to disperse homeless people by spraying them down with a foul-smelling thing.
Fortunately, there are some human rights activists in France who said maybe we shouldn't be doing that.
Yeah.
Here in the States, census data was released. It shows the nation's median household income grew slightly in 2006, but that is related to the fact people are working more hours and there are more highly educated people in the workforce getting paid. But here is the flip side of that. The College Board released SAT scores for this year's incoming freshman student. Turns out the scores went down this year. Biggest drop in math scores in 3 decades.
Hmm.
By the way, number of those uninsured increased about 2 million.
Update from the Bryant Park Martial Arts Desk. 3 teenagers arrested last week in Oregon after months of investigations. They were dressed as ninjas. They had been breaking into houses, scampering, you have to assume silently, over rooftops, climbing trees, quote, just like squirrels. That's what said the police in Rogue River, Oregon. Earlier in the summer, a police officer chased one of the would-be ninjas up a tree. They'd been active for a year and a half. This hits close to home for me, Allison, because I was, along with my friend Ben McGow and Donald Whitehouse, part of a ninja club in the Green Lake neighborhood of Seattle. You
Is
may
that
have heard
true?
Of this. Yeah, there's a thing that happens to, I think, almost all boys between the age of, say, 10 and 15. They become obsessed with being ninjas. I'm just now getting out of that phase.
My favorite part of the story is, I guess they got a tip, the police. Some parent called in and said, my kid dresses up like a ninja and runs around at night. Is that bad?
Also, by the way, these kids were all white.
New York City big story. I think this is a big story all over. Leona Helmsley's will. The details have been released. She is leaving $12 million to her dog. And her two grandkids, two of them got squat. The conditions of her will, the grandchildren must visit their father's grave at least once a year, sign the book to prove it. She left $100,000 to her chauffeur, but the dog named Trouble, a little Maltese, $12 million pup.
It's like at every time she had a chance to not be the stereotypical crazy, mean, rich lady in New York, she just chose to go right down stereotype lane. $12 million to her dog. That is The Ramble.
From the Bryant Park Project, from NPR News.
Astronauts of the past 45 years have all returned to Earth, struggling to convey the enormity of what they've discovered, and with their perceptions clearly changed. To be able to extend that privilege to people from all walks of life has been a long-held ambition at Virgin. We're designing our spacecraft so that each of our passengers will have the room and the freedom to enjoy the amazing sensation of weightlessness. Large panoramic windows will allow you to see clearly the curved Earth over 100 kilometers below.
That's Richard Branson talking about the space airline kind of thing that he's attempting to develop. It's called Virgin Galactic. You will not find it on Orbitz or Travelocity if you put that in there. Just FYI.
Nonstop, please.
Yeah, I found out the hard way. According to the website they've set up, the initial flights are going to originate from the Mojave Desert near Los Angeles. They've already run into some trouble, though, this summer. In July, they had some workers die at the launch site while they were doing something involving nitrous oxide. We're going to try to find out a little more about that by talking to Lon Raines. He's the editor of Space News, a weekly newspaper that covers space technology. Hi, Lon.
Well, hello, Luke and Allison both.
Thanks for coming on. What exactly are you actually launching into space right now, Lon?
I just about launched into space.
Yeah, I think our engineer, Josh, is asking if you can pick up the phone receiver. Are we on speakerphone? Are you being futuristic?
I can't actually do that. Hang on a second. Let me pick up the phone.
Brilliant.
Can you hear me now?
Oh, yes.
Oh, so much better.
Houston,
okay.
We've solved our problem. So what exactly happened in the Mojave Desert with these people dying? What were they doing and what happened?
Well, the truth is people don't actually know exactly what happened. It is under investigation by California's version of OSHA. They were doing what's called a flow test. They were moving fuel through this hybrid engine. And they had, as you mentioned, a terrible explosion that killed three people and rather badly injured three others. And it is a setback. I don't know how much of a setback it is, but it's certainly for Virgin Galactic. And let's be clear, Scaled Composites is the company. Burt Rutan's company is the company that's building that vehicle and was doing the test. And Virgin Galactic will be buying the vehicles from them.
Right. It wasn't like they were trying to test this actual space vehicle and it sort of blew up or something. This was actually a kind of a contractor issue that happened to be at the site.
That's exactly right. And you know, they've said it's not clear whether this is even a problem with the engine or if this was an industrial accident. And that, you know, hopefully in a few months we'll know that. But I think it is something that gives a bit of a black eye to a company that is very conscious, and when you talk to them, they are very conscious of the need for safety and how important it is to convince their customers, and they have a lot of them lined up already, that this will be a safe product.
What's it going to cost somebody if they want to fly on one of these missions?
Right now, the price is $200,000. That's going through directly through the company. I think you can go onto their website and sign up. They say that they have, I think, some $20 million already in deposits, including some people who've put up full deposits.
Will they take a check?
Yeah. You do get free cocktails.
I'm sure they will,
which is awesome.
Because there's plenty of time for that check to clear between now and the launch.
Well, considering the setback and just the kind of challenges of this, when would the most likely time be that someone could actually get on this thing and fly up in space?
Well, let me give you my best guess, and okay. I'll tell you what they're saying. My best guess is that it's going to be early in the next decade. Now, what they've said officially is that they hope to be doing test flights with the vehicle next year in 2008, and they've been pretty consistent in saying that they had, they'd hope to fly passengers no earlier than 2009. And, these things in space always take longer than people think. People who are in the space business are very optimistic, and these things tend to take a lot of time. And as I said earlier, they are very focused on the safety issue, and the Virgin Galactic officials have told me that their message to Burt Rutan and his people is safety first. We want a very reliable vehicle, and that comes before setting any arbitrary timetable for launching.
Can you just kind of describe what they're planning on doing with the actual flight? I mean, this isn't going to be where you fly from Mojave to Paris in 4 seconds. This is going to be you go up in space, like actually into, like, can you see the moon? Are you going to fly past the moon?
Well, for those who are my age, we remember the very earliest U.S. Human space flight, which is the suborbital launches of Alan Shepard and Gus Grissom. This is just up and down to about 65 miles. And you're going to get, for your $200,000, about 4 minutes of weightlessness. And I have seen the video that you guys were playing as we came on. And let me tell you, I saw it in a room full of people who were attending a conference that was sponsored by one of the organizations that's very big on this whole idea of private access to space. And in that room, there were people, and some I know, that weren't excited about it before, and it shows you the power of Virgin marketing. They were ready to go, and they were ready to sign up. Now, the other 4 minutes of weightlessness doesn't sound like a lot for $200,000, but this is part of the adventure tourism market, and they're going to do a lot of things, I think, in the that people will find exciting in the week that leads up to your flight.
Yeah. Leona Helmsley's dog has already signed up.
She should be. I wasn't in the will trip. Either. I was very disappointed, just like the grandchildren.
Lon, if you scrape together the $20K, are you going to try to do this?
I will probably wait and make sure that they've had a few flights under their belt. And then I'll also wait for raising that amount of money. Now, what we haven't talked about is orbital tourism.
Well, Lon, we're going to have to actually save that for another space discussion because we're kind of up against the clock. But thank you for coming on, Lon Raines, the editor of Space News. And, we'll see you up in the wild blue yonder, I guess.
All right. My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is NPR.
From space news to terrestrial news.
All the news that's fit to say or come out of my mouth.
Matt Martinez, go for it.
Thanks, guys.
It's the worst transition ever.
I know. It's okay. It's a work in progress. The Taliban released 12 of 19 South Korean missionaries held hostage today. South Korea reaffirmed a pledge it made to the Taliban before the hostage crisis began to withdraw its troops from Afghanistan by the end of this year. Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr ordered a 6-month suspension of activities by his Mahdi army militia. It's an effort to reorganize the force. A military jury reprimanded the only officer court-martialed in the Abu Ghraib abuse scandal. He will not serve any prison time for disobeying an order to keep silent about the abuse investigation. And it's been 2 years since Hurricane Katrina made landfall and devastated New Orleans. An update on the state of the city coming up later on the program. I'm Matt Martinez. The news is always online at npr.org. Back to you guys.
I just want to say, Matt, I didn't think your transition was bad.
No,
you thought my transition was bad?
Exactly.
Ours, collectively. The one you were the person making it.
It's a collective transition.
But, yeah.
Yes.
All right. Sorry.
I didn't think it was that bad. Diapers, we don't need no stinking diapers. If you're a parent and sick of smelly nappies, our next story is for you. You might want to join the diaper-free movement. Its followers believe that you start potty training little Ava or Ethan even before he or she celebrates the first birthday. The theory is babies are born with an instinctive ability to signal when they gotta go. And parents need to engage in what's called elimination communication. Doesn't that sound like Schoolhouse Rock, like conjunction?
I missed that Saturday morning, but, my mom probably wouldn't have minded if I had gotten hip to it at an earlier age. 15 is late. People say it's late in life.
Dr. Emily Davidson is a pediatrician at the Boston Children's Hospital. She specializes in developmental and behavioral pediatrics. Dr. Davidson, hey.
Hi, it's great to be with you.
So what constitutes elimination communication? How does little Jacob tell me he's got to go?
Well, the idea behind elimination communication is that even newborns will make some signals when they're about to move their bowels or urinate, and that parents can become attuned to these signals and learn when their baby's about to go, and then also help their babies associate a special sound or gesture that they make as parents that help them, even from infancy, be able to relieve themselves on cue.
Now, how young are we actually talking about trying to potty train Christopher?
Well, I think that the term potty train is really more appropriate when you're talking about older kids.
Okay.
With the tiny babies, it's really helping them learn how to eliminate in the appropriate places where you want them to go. And it's a real back and forth dance between the parent and the baby. And so babies as young as infants, newborns, some parents who practice elimination communication will, instead of putting their baby in a diaper, will just lie them down on a cloth diaper or hold them in a sling with a cloth diaper in it, and they'll start to notice what is their baby's pattern of urination. And when they start to understand the pattern, or what the baby does, is the baby make a little grimacing face or move in a different way, pick up on that signal, and then at the same time go, make a little sound, so the baby starts to understand, oh, that sound is when I go.
And then you take them and hold them over the toilet?
Ultimately?
As they get a little older, you can start to hold them over the toilet, or sometimes parents hold them over a sink because it's a little bit easier to do, but you just can put your hands under their thighs, hold them with their facing away from you, and
hopefully
make that little sound, so they're in a sort of squat position, and then they go.
Now, so they learn to pee in the sink, so that's good.
I have to believe there are a lot of people who do not sign on to this. What's the most controversial part of this diaper-free movement?
I think what pediatricians sometimes worry about is the idea that already busy, burdened parents would start to feel more pressure to do yet something else. The other thing I think people worry about is coercive means of toilet training before children are before they're developmentally ready to do it.
Now, am I right in saying that you did this with your children?
I would be what the elimination communication crowd calls a part-timer. so I wasn't I came into it actually through watching my daughter. When she was about between 6 and 8 months old, I started to notice that every single morning I would nurse her. I put her down while I took my shower, and when I came back, she'd have a poop in her diaper. And I thought, you know, she's so regular. Why couldn't I be just putting her on a potty instead of having her go in her diaper? And I remember that when I was a resident, I had learned that children in other parts of the world never use diapers and use this kind of elimination communication. And I thought, well, if I had a child, I work with children who have significant developmental disabilities, and so some of them are never going to meet those traditional milestones of walking to the bathroom, pulling down their pants, telling you they have to go, the kinds of things that, as pediatricians, we tend to say you have to be ready to do before you can do traditional toilet training. And so if a parent had came to me and said, my child is very regularly showing me that she's about to go, I would say, well, put them on the toilet. So I went and bought a tiny potty and put my daughter on it, and she went. And so we started to do elimination communication, and I learned a little more about the diaper-free baby group and the what parents were doing with younger infants.
You brought up an interesting point that some of the people who are for this diaper-free movement say it's just it's a cultural difference. Americans have a big ew factor about this, but that this is practiced in other parts of the world.
That's very true. In places like Africa, India, China, people don't use diapers the way we do here, and certainly they learn how to cue and to work with their child. So it's a new challenge, kind of introducing it into our culture. But even in our culture, there are significant cultural differences over time in how we do the process of toilet training. In the 1950s, the majority of children were trained between 18 months and 2 years of age, and now we've moved up to a point where most children aren't trained until 2, 2.5, or 3, and even older. So I don't think children have changed physiologically over time, but how their parents are handling elimination, and particularly I think now that we have diapers that are so absorbent and comfortable, children aren't particularly motivated at young ages to get out of them.
Mm-hmm. I'm just going to chill here in my huggies, basically. Hey, Dr. Emily Davidson, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it, and taking time off from Boston Children's Hospital, the 5 minutes or so to talk with us.
Thank you very much.
You know, Allison, first of all, we got a lot of bathroom This is a heavily bathroom-centric show. We've got the Larry Craig stuff. We've got the little children's in the bathroom. And I was hoping we could have a moment to spend some private time with Luke. Because there's a topic that we read about today that's kind of... it's in my craw. I wanted to just sort of get it off my chest. Okay, Burning Man is happening this week out in the Nevada desert, and that's the big sort of camp out where like 40,000 people, they show up. In the words of the festival, they show up to connect each individual to his or her creative powers and to make art and to share ideas. Basically, in my estimation, the worst possible way you could spend a week, if you ask me. And Burning Man, I guess, this is what I've been able to deduce from the internet today. It started out in the 80s as this sort of get-together for... guys who really liked wearing mandals and white chicks who are into sarong skirts. But over the years, it's gotten a lot more popular, and it's expanded out to now also include frat boys who want to score chicks. So that's also good. So the big finale of Burning Man every year is that they burn down this big wooden statue. That's the Burning Man. And early yesterday morning, everybody gathered around the town square to watch as it went up in flames. The only problem is that it was Tuesday, and the guy is not supposed to actually burn until Saturday.
That's a problem.
Yeah. Police have charged 35-year-old Paul Addis. He's a San Francisco artist, with arson in the premature lighting of Burning Man. They say, though, the officials say they think they can actually rebuild a scaled-down version of the thing in time for the big ceremony on Saturday. I'm kind of amazed this doesn't happen all the time. If you think about how many hallucinogens that a lot of people there are using.
Allegedly.
By their own admission, if you've been on the internet
at
all. Yeah. I guess I would say the most disturbing thing I uncovered during my internet research on this bacchanal, where lots of people, by their own admission, are using drugs and walking around naked, is that at Burning Man this year, as in years past, admission for kids 12 and under is free. So good job, parents of America. Good news for you if you want to head out to Burning Man and bring the little ones. In fact, you know what? It'd be a great place to work on elimination training right there in the desert. And that is Private Time with Luke.
I'm coming back to the microphone now.
That was the classiest music ever to talk about potty training kids in the desert.
Yeah.
Or whatever it was
or
about.
Something like that. Coming up on the Bryant Park Project from NPR News, we will revisit what happened 2 years ago today, the worst disaster, natural disaster to hit the United States. Hurricane Katrina came ashore in the Gulf Coast. We'll talk to a reporter, New Orleans native, lived there past 30 years, who rode out the storm and has been watching the rebuilding.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about lame duck presidents, which is not a pejorative about the president. It's just actually what you call a guy when they're done, they're not going to be reelected.
Yeah.
And the president's got like 17 months left, but he's been under fire. It feels like his entire presidency and all of his, posse of Texas folks are heading back into that, that dusty trail. So the question is like, what's the president going to be able to accomplish during the last 17 months of his term? And also historically, what do presidents tend to do as they're kind of running out the clock? So we'll talk to Robert Dalek about that. I think this is the part where we're supposed to say, this is the Bryant Park Project.
From NPR News.
Thank you.
And welcome back to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. Hey, everybody, I'm Allison Stewart.
I'm Luke Burbank. Coming up, we're going to talk to a New Orleans resident and a journalist. His name's Doug McCash. We're going to kind of get an update on, you know, what looks the same in New Orleans and what doesn't 2 years after Hurricane Katrina hit. Right now, though, we're talking about President Bush just before the break and how he might be feeling a little lonely these days, you know. Alberto Gonzalez left this week, and that's sort of officially the last one of his high-level Texas homies that have now left the White House. At one point, he had Karen Hughes, who was a close advisor, also a guy named Scott McClellan was a spokesman. Harriet Myers, legal counsel to the White House. Dan Bartlett was a close advisor. And then, of course, Karl Rove.
Yes.
Turd Blossom, as the president affectionately called him. All of those people are now gone, leaving the president sort of looking down the barrel of his last 17 months in office without some of these sort of close advisors. And we were wondering if he's going to be able to get anything done with these new staffers that he's bringing in. There are a whole bunch of people that are kind of working in these positions on an interim basis. And as everybody knows, at your real job, you know, someone who's filling in, they never quite know what's going on. So we were wondering if he's kind of like a high school senior, you know, at the end of May. and also the burning question, will he TP the Capitol Rotunda? That's obviously on everybody's mind. We wanted to get a little history on lame duck presidents, what they tend to do in their last time in office. Robert Dalek is the author of many presidential histories, most recently Nixon and Kissinger, Partners in Power. Thanks, Mr. Dalek, for coming on.
Sure. My pleasure.
So what, if anything, can the president actually accomplish between now and the end of his term, you think?
Probably nothing. Nothing good. Anyway.
Tell us how you really feel.
Well, how bad a president is he? You know, he's going to struggle because he doesn't have control of Congress. As you just described it, all his close associates have been showing the door or have fled town. And what is he going to get done? He's certainly not going to get any big domestic agendas pushed through Congress. He's going to be burdened by this Iraq war. He's not going to let go of it, and he's going to want to keep the troops there and leave it as a legacy, so to speak, to the next president. It's going to be, I think, kind of ugly. There are going to be lots of fireworks, angry words, and of course, we're getting into, if not already in it, the 2008 election campaign. And, of course, the Democrats will seize on anything and everything they can to exploit their political advantage, which they certainly have now. And Bush will do everything he can to preserve his legacy. You know, presidents in their closing months, they like to take my job over, act like a historian.
Right.
Very good at it. They should leave it to historians like me.
Is there a chance, though, that if in fact the president kind of puts policy stuff aside and says, look, I'm going to make it my full-time goal to just try to rehab my image?
Yeah.
Could he accomplish that?
Well, you know, Lyndon Johnson did some of that and was sort of successful at it, at least temporarily. March 31, '68, he knew he was in the tank. He couldn't run again for president. He couldn't even go outside. I mean, people marching around the White House, hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today? The Vietnam War. So he announced he wasn't going to run. He was going to cut back on the bombing of Vietnam, and he was going to start peace negotiations. And instantly, his approval ratings jumped up. Nothing does wonders for your approval ratings like telling people you're not going to run and you're getting out of town. So he did get a couple of things done in the last months of his presidency. A civil rights bill, housing, equal housing, and then he was able to get a 10% tax surcharge because we were running big deficits over that Vietnam War. But, Bush has lost his credibility. You cannot govern effectively if people don't trust you. And, do they trust what he says about Gonzalez? Does every 15 minutes there's another turning point in this war and everything is looking up and it's all rosy? And so, I mean, he would have to do a lot of repair work.
Don't the American people seem to have a pretty tremendous capacity for forgetting about how much they dislike somebody in this office? I mean, I remember a time when Bill Clinton was just pretty much reviled, or at least certainly looked down upon, even by Democrats, just for his, you know, Lewinsky stuff. And yet, you know, the guy is like the second coming now. I mean,
Well, that's you're right. I mean, people in this country have limited historical memories. That's partly because those of us who teach history do such a lousy job at it, maybe. But
come on now. Come on now, Professor Dalek. It's okay.
But just joking. We, I mean, you're right. But you see, what influences them an awful lot is who comes next. If you have a next president who looks even worse than Bush, it's going to sort of raise his standing. You know, he's made his father look good. I mean, that wasn't his intention, I'm sure, but his father looks much better than he does. So, yeah, there is an impulse to, and also the public is mercurial. His approval ratings could go up if he did something dramatic that was a gesture of reconciliation toward the other party, something dramatic that happened with Iraq, or if there were some kind of new 9/11 attack, perish the thought. It could at least give him what the political scientists call the rally effect, you know, boost him. But on the other hand, it could also bring him down, because people then on reflection might say, hey, whatever happened with Homeland Security? You know, we thought we were less vulnerable. And so, you know, it's very hard to predict, but one can make the educated guess that the last 17 months are going to be a pretty rough ride for him. But he's very mindful now about what his legacy is going to be. And it's going to be he's tied hand and foot to Iraq. And so he's going to scramble as hard as he can to put the best possible face on that.
Well, and the best thing about, you know, the ranch in Crawford where he likes to clear brush is that when this is all said and done, no radios, no TVs, just be out there chopping brush and probably won't even care.
They all come to hate the media. Can I use some expletives to describe what?
No, you can't.
Hey, no, you can't.
But we're going to thank you for being on the show, Robert Dalek.
Don't get saucy with us, Mister.
Presidential historian and author of Nixon and Kissinger: Partners in Power. Thank you very much.
Sure,
thank
my
you.
Pleasure.
All right. And if he can do it without expletives, we'd like to welcome Matt Martinez to join us with some news.
This is NPR.
I think I can. I think I can do this without expletives. Here we go. I'll give it a shot. Iraqi Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr will halt all armed actions by his Mehdi army militia. Idaho Senator Larry Craig says he's not gay and he loves his wife and that he's innocent, even though he pled guilty to lewd conduct charges while in a men's public restroom. He didn't plead guilty in the men's restroom. He pled guilty to lewd conduct in a men's public restroom. Clarify that. The Taliban released 12 of 19 South Korean missionaries being held hostage. The U.S. military released 8 Iranians detained in Baghdad over unauthorized weapons. And the Census Bureau released statistics. They say income is up, poverty's down, and the number of people without health care was up to 47 million people in 2006. These and other stories are always online at npr.org. I'm Matt Martinez. Back to you guys.
Thank you, Matt. Everybody, think about it. Where were you 2 years ago this morning? Our next guest was in New Orleans, his home for almost 30 years, as that massive hurricane we all came to know as Katrina hit Louisiana.
New Orleans is no longer safe to live
Hurricane
in.
Hurricane Katrina roared toward the Gulf Coast.
This deteriorating situation in the city of New Orleans.
Some people in Mississippi got out. Tragically, many others stayed put, surviving against all odds.
As the house just filled up with water.
By the time the storm left and the levees broke, there was an estimated $150 billion worth of damage to the Gulf Coast region. Doug McCash is an arts and critic reporter for the Times-Picayune. So, Doug, where were you 2 years ago this morning? What did you see?
2 years ago, when Katrina hit, we were just talking about it in the office. I had fallen asleep in my cubicle. We stayed in the building to ride out the storm so that we could report the next morning. I'd fallen asleep in my cubicle when the storm was raging outside and was so sound asleep that I didn't know a window had been blown out on the floor below. And my editor nudged me into consciousness with his foot, kicked me, in other words, until I got up and left my cubicle and got where it was safe.
When did you realize that this just wasn't any giant storm that reporters were hunkering down for and people? When did you realize the severity of it all?
Personally, that same editor, James O'Byrne, and I had ridden our bicycles to work. And the reason we did was because in a hurricane, you know, a normal hurricane with tree limbs down, you can get around on a bike. And we rode out to Lakeview, a neighborhood that everybody knows now, to see what the situation was. And we ran into a flood. And that's how we knew that the situation was, much worse and much different than we'd originally thought.
And as you think about the anniversary of Katrina and you think about your daily life and the daily lives of people who have either come back to the city or who never left, what do you think has changed the most? And also, what's changed the least?
Oh, gosh. Everything has changed. A third of us are gone.
Yeah.
Two-thirds of the population remains in the city, and a third are elsewhere. And that has changed everything. On a day-to-day basis, if you and I were sitting in a coffee shop in uptown New Orleans, where just the hurricane struck but not the flood, it would look very much as it did in the summer of 2005 before the storm. But if we were to drive out to Lakeview or New Orleans East to the Ninth Ward that you've heard so much about, it is still devastated. So there's a balance. You can go out to a restaurant, have a picnic in your backyard, or have a barbecue in your backyard and not know that there's been big changes. But the next day you're driving around and it strikes you again, oh, my God, look what's happened, you know?
What do you, for Americans who haven't actually been to New Orleans since Katrina, maybe have heard a little bit about it, you know, this year, it seems like the coverage just sort of obviously trails off each year a little bit. What do you think people don't exactly get about the situation right now in New Orleans?
What don't they get? I think just imagine, everyone. Imagine a suburban neighborhood, you know, inside of a city, and those are the neighborhoods that flooded. And imagine if you drove around and probably one or two out of 10 houses still stand completely vacant and with watermarks on the side and the, you know, and crosses on the front door from where the from where people were evacuated. It's haunting in a way. There are ghost towns inside of a major American city.
One of the things that came to light as a result of Katrina was how desperately poor some people are in New Orleans, and were forgotten, let's just say, by political officials and by many people, or people didn't even know they were there. You know, $160 billion Congress appropriated for recovery and $34 billion for long-term rebuilding. Has the money reached the area where the poorest live?
Money is reaching us, you know, no doubt about it, and things are being rebuilt, and the situation is improving. And yet, as in almost everything, I think the poor hear about it last. If you if you didn't own your house, or you know, if your house was in one of the most affected areas, if you were in public housing, you are probably still feeling the effects of the storm, day after day after day.
What are some of the positive things, if there are any?
It is hard to find a silver lining in this situation. This city was forever altered by that storm. And those of us who still live here and whose lives are back in order, It's hard to look back and say, well, you know, here's the good thing that came out of Katrina. There may not be one.
But, I mean, what are the positive developments post-Katrina in the sense that, are some neighborhoods being rebuilt? Are people coming back in some fashion?
Yes. The population continues to grow, apparently. We are promised, re-engineered levees. We have new pumps at the lakefront that should alleviate some of the pressure on the canals that flooded into those neighborhoods. And there's a spirit of rebuilding and a spirit of, we're gonna take this, town back, by God. That's I suppose that's a positive thing.
If you can think of one thing that is still really desperately needed in New Orleans, what is it?
One thing that's desperately needed, gosh, I suppose low-income housing is needed. People who were
people who had to leave low-income housing across the city, still there's, you know, there aren't a lot of alternatives for them in the city. What else is needed? Oh, gosh. I think we need those levees to be finished because we've been lucky. There have been no hurricanes or hurricane threats to New Orleans since Katrina, you know, no immediate hurricane threats. And I think that that has allowed us to be in this recovery mindset. If Dean had decided to come north and had come to the coast of Louisiana or Mississippi, I think we would be feeling a whole lot less secure.
Well, let's just keep our fingers crossed that that money will get where it needs to go, to those areas you mentioned, as well as to repairing those levees. Doug McCash from the New Orleans Times-Picayune, thanks for sharing your experiences with us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Doug. All right, Allison, we talked about it earlier in the show. We wanted to get back to the Larry Craig thing for a moment in case you're just joining us. He's the Idaho senator who just came to light that he pled guilty to lewd conduct in a bathroom in the Minneapolis-St. Paul airport. But it kind of gets complicated from there.
Yeah, we wanted to figure out exactly what he was supposedly guilty of because the question came up in our morning meeting. How can you be arrested for signaling you want to hook up in a bathroom as opposed to actually hooking up in the bathroom? I mean, if you went into a bar these days and you saw somebody saying, hey, I want to get with you, could you get arrested? So here is the Minnesota law. Craig was charged with disorderly conduct and peeping. So disorderly conduct, according to Minnesota law, whoever does any of the following in a public or private place, including on a school bus, don't know why that's in there, knowing or having reasonable grounds to know that it will or will intend to anger, alarm, disturb others, provoke assault, or breach the peace, is guilty of disorderly conduct, which is a misdemeanor. So I guess if you're in a bar and you sort of, you know, maybe grab your crotch and try to pick up a girl, then you could be arrested for disorderly conduct? I don't know.
I think probably the police would say that this is a little bit like pornography. It's hard to define, but you know it when you see it. Like, there's normal, you know, male bathroom behavior.
Right.
And then there's this other stuff. And I think that they probably would say this allows them, this gives them the ability to kind of, you know, basically get somebody out of there when they're doing something that everyone who's in the bathroom understands is a little bit shady. But it is weird because, you know, you could kind of say, look, I was tapping my foot because I wanted to meet someone and say, let's go back to my hotel, which isn't illegal probably.
And tap dance? Go back
maybe.
To sleep. Maybe.
Sure.
Never know.
Do some elimination training.
Let's talk about the peeping aspect. It actually has a legal definition here. It says a person is guilty of a gross misdemeanor who surreptitiously gazes, stares, or peeps in the window or other aperture of a sleeping room in a hotel, a tanning booth, or other place where a reasonable person would likely have the expectation of privacy. It goes on about a part, something about private parts and all that. So why this becomes an issue is because Craig actually pled guilty to the disorderly conduct issue, but not the peeping. So we're going to post a link to smokinggun.com, or we'll post it ourselves, what the police officer actually said. Craig did.
Yeah.
And then you can compare it with these two definitions and let us know what you think. Did he do what the officer said? It's npr.org/Bryant Park.
We're also going to have a link up to that Virgin Galactic video of them trying to fly around in space and lots of other good things at the Bryant Park Project blog. That's almost it for us. Dan Pashman directed the show. MJ Davis produced, along with Lauren Spohr. Josh Rogerson driving the bus. Matt Martinez, supervising senior producer, also reading the news for us so excellently. I'm Luke Burbank.
And I'm Allison Stewart. This was the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.
We hit every clock.
My flag boy and your flag boy sitting by the fire. My flag boy to your flag boy, I'm gonna set your flag on fire. Talking about here now.